Hello there. Today is Monday, March 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, not under control, coronavirus concerns are growing as the COVID-19 continues to spread worldwide.
CDC, wake up. Let the states test. Let private labs test. Let's increase as quickly as possible our testing capacity.
Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden get big endorsements over the weekend. Also ahead, North Korea makes another provocative move. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. death toll from the new coronavirus reached at least 21. California's governor is reassuring the public that none of the passengers from a ship carrying people infected with the virus will have to stay on that ship, and they will be released into the public before undergoing a 14-day quarantine. The Grand Princess, carrying more than 3,500 people from 54 countries, is expected to dock today in Oakland in the East San Francisco Bay Area. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The cruise ship can be seen moving off the coast. The captain told passengers last night those requiring acute medical treatment and hospitalization will be taken to healthcare facilities in California. Others will go to federally operated isolation sites or transported out of state. Passenger Karen Dever says she and her husband have been holed up in their room since Thursday, feel fine, and are anxious to get off the boat.
You know, at some point, it has to stop. So if they test me and say I'm negative, well, then let me go. You know, don't keep me.
The Grand Princess has about 24 reported cases of coronavirus. The ship is carrying more than 3,500 people. I'm Julie Walker.
With the number of confirmed infections in the U.S. climbing above 500 as testing for the virus increases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the National Institutes of Health's infectious disease chief, said Sunday that widespread closure of a city or region is possible. But New York Governor Andrew Cuomo at a news conference Sunday said that's unlikely in his state. But he is urging health officials to speed up the testing process.
CDC, wake up. Let the states test. Let private labs test. Let's increase as quickly as possible our testing capacity so we identify the positive people, so we can isolate them, and we're successful in our containment.
Meanwhile, Italy imposed a virtual lockdown across a large region of its wealthy north Sunday, including the financial capital of Milan, in a drastic new attempt to try to contain a rapidly growing outbreak. The total number known of COVID-19 in Italy surpassed South Korea Sunday, becoming the country with the second highest number of infections after China. Italian government authorities say the country now has more than 7,000 cases. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
Italy has never experienced anything like the emergency restrictions approved overnight and which are effective from Sunday. The wealthy region of Lombardy and 14 other provinces in the nearby regions of Emilia-Romagna, Veneto and Piedmont have been locked down in efforts to stop the spread of COVID-19. This will affect busy cities like Milan, Venice, Parma and Modena, as well as others. The Prime Minister said the new measures will be enforced by police. More than 16 million people living in Italy's northern areas will be impacted.
Early in the outbreak, Italy was zealous in testing those living in hotbed areas, even if they had no symptoms or close contact with someone known to be infected. So far, Italian health personnel have performed some 50,000 tests. Meanwhile, as the COVID-19 spreads across European nations, it is also spreading concern. Joining us to talk more about it is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, France now seen a huge increase in confirmed cases just overnight and over the weekend, while Italy is taking some pretty aggressive actions, and it sounds like other European nations are following those aggressive steps in Italy.
Now, the reason that decree was put in place was that virtually overnight, Saturday to Sunday, there was an increase of about 25% in the number of reported cases. So it went up from around 5,800 to somewhere around 7,300 cases of the coronavirus. So the government in Rome really felt it had to act. And let's not forget also, across the country, the government in Rome has closed down schools in affected areas. Schools and universities will not reopen until mid-March. We've also got cinemas, theatres, entertainment venues nationwide. They've been ordered to suspend their activities. So that's just in Italy. Here in France, of course, there was an enormous increase over the weekend. You've had a fivefold increase in cases in just 1 week. There's now more than 1,100 cases, 200 new cases just in 24 hours over the weekend. What the government has put in place there has meant that gatherings of more than 1,000 people cannot now take place. That involves sports activities, it involves large theatre events, large entertainment venues as well. So they've also asked people not to go and visit the elderly, not to go and visit the sick, saying that anyone who could possibly be at risk, and that is again the elderly and those who are already sick, you should stay away from them, do not go visiting. And of course in Germany, there you've got more than 900 cases in Germany. You've got them in three quite large clusters in Western Germany. Again, the government there is asking that gatherings of more than 1,000 people also be cancelled for the time being while these governments try and get a handle on this, try and get in place all the measures they need to so at least they feel that they can curb the spread of the coronavirus.
Austria's chancellor is calling on other European countries to adopt the containment measures that are as dramatic as Italy has taken. Obviously, the way European countries are so interconnected and people are going from one country to another freely, it just seems like they would have no choice across the EU.
That is the problem. When it comes to health, this is a national jurisdiction. It is not something that the European Union, the 27 countries of the European Union, can impose on all members. So that is a problem. But they are trying to organize, put together some sort of support across the member states so everyone is, if you like, working same, if you like, the same plan. This has really been the problem, is that you're getting all these countries where, as you rightly say, there's freedom of movement across all these borders, people traveling around. They need to do something about that, put in place areas around the border where some sort of control could be put in. Now, what they're going to be looking at is, are these just going to be certain measures where, say, for example, Austria, which has a border with Italy, and those sorts of places where you actually are right against a border with a known area that has all these clusters, or are they going to have a look again at bringing in these sorts of measures, such as in Italy, where really you're looking at clamping down on freedom of movement that is something that is just part of Western liberal democracies, and Europe is just not used to that sort of measures.
That's Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Thank you so much. Well, a U.S. envoy says the United States has offered humanitarian assistance to Iran to help them deal with their coronavirus outbreak, but the regime rejected the offer. Iran has reported 107 virus deaths, making it one of the hardest hit nations outside of China. Five Americans are being held in Iran. And the envoy added that Washington is working through Switzerland on this and couldn't provide more details. But joining us now is Benham Bentaleblou, senior fellow with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. It's my understanding that Iran was offered some help and aid and refused any sort of assistance. So we really don't know what's going on there. I know there are some concerns from people in Western nations that have loved ones there that can't get any information. What can you tell us?
So for a while now, we've been used to a series of threats from the Islamic Republic, different security threats. And the latest threat that we're facing now is actually a biohazard. And it's one where the lack of transparency hurts not just people in the region, but people all around the world. There is a legitimate concern that the numbers that are being underreported by the government inside the country actually are two or threefold more than what we hear nowadays. And I think more importantly, the offers for help are being rejected for purposes of pride or to score political points. If you remember previously, the U.S. had offered humanitarian aid after earthquakes in the mid-2000s. The regime rejected those, and I think now again it's poised to reject help, be able to signal that they have it all under control. In fact, the Supreme Leader Khamenei a few days ago had talked about the coronavirus not being a big deal, despite Iran becoming a regional epicenter. So I think most unfortunately, poor public health policy plus enmity with international community has put the country in the position it is today, which is most unfortunate.
It sounds like, from what we're hearing, that outside of China, Iran has one of the deadliest outbreaks.
That's right. Iran, Italy, South Korea, outside of China, these countries, there's significant travel warnings for, and of course, there's places in Italy where they're doing quarantines, as well as South Korea. Iran has formally rejected the full city quarantine model, but it has now twice shut down Friday prayers, which is quite historic for the regime in the country. But you have people now sending videos of health workers, medical workers, aid workers, dancing, trying to be triumphant, despite the fact that they are on the front lines of this crisis, getting exposed to the virus, as well as trying to save Iranians from some incompetence that the regime has been signaling at home.
And it took a while for them to even acknowledge that they even had anyone infected there. Is that correct?
That's right. And I think nothing sums this up better than the early responses, which I call the botched phase of the response to this, which is you had elected and appointed health officials, people who were supposed to be representatives of the public trust or of actually the regime caring for segments of the population, end up going on TV, end up actually meeting with reporters, end up conducting cabinet interviews, sweating, sneezing, coughing in confined spaces with other individuals. Nothing typifies or signals the problem here better than that.
I know they were concerned about parliamentary elections there at the time of this outbreak beginning to ramp up.
There are rumors, and in fact, I'm inclined to believe it, of course, that the regime knew about it, but because it's been putting a lot of stake on the recent parliamentary elections, which still had a historically low turnout, even if you look at the official numbers, let alone what you hear about unofficial numbers, which are essentially half of that, that the regime knew about it, but didn't want to scare anyone into staying at home, and hence it was also pushing people to come out into the street and, for the sake of politics, expose segments of the population to the virus.
Have you talked to anyone over there that's concerned? I know that Iranians typically have a lot of faith in their healthcare professionals and their healthcare system, but it sounds like that's waning as well.
For the sake of the safety of people inside the country, I tend to, when I get information, I tend to be a little bit more indirect, so not to have that direct communication. But a video that I was sent, which later on ended up being on social media, was actually an aid worker in the slum of, I don't know what city exactly, and showing young children how to properly apply liquid sanitizer and to properly secure face masks. And I think the only thing you can say about this is that regardless of the government response, at least you have a series of people in the aid worker and medical profession who are doing everything, including risking their own life and limb, to at least help fellow citizens. And that type of video is inspiring. The problem is you have a sea of despair amid this one or two drops of hope.
All right, that's Benabin Talablu, senior fellow with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Well, some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. The first hearing in the trial of four fugitives suspected in the downing of a Malaysia Airlines flight in July of 2014 begins today in Amsterdam. It comes more than 5 years after the plane was shot down by a Russian missile in Ukraine. Prosecutors believe the suspects are in Russia. Venezuela's Elections Council reported Sunday that a weekend fire destroyed voting machines stored in its main warehouse in Caracas. Nearly 50,000 voting machines and almost 6,000 computers went up in flames, complicating parliamentary elections this year. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan is urging Greece to open its gates to refugees trying to enter the European Union from Turkey and says he hopes to win more support on migration from the EU. At talks later today, tens of thousands of migrants have been trying to get into Greece. Well, amid all the coronavirus concerns in South Korea, there is more activity coming from its neighbor, North Korea. Joining us for details is VOA Seoul correspondent Bill Gallo. Bill, what can you tell us?
Well, North Korea fired what appears to be three projectiles, probably short-range rockets, into the sea off its east coast. We don't have a lot of details, but it appears that these were fired from the eastern part of the country into the ocean, and this is their second launch in the past week.
Any speculation as to why they're ramping it up now in the midst of all the other crises all over the world with the coronavirus?
There's a lot of speculation, and the answer is nobody knows. I mean, the past week has been quite inconsistent and erratic, even by North Korean standards. We have, on last Monday, two short-range missiles being launched. Then on Tuesday, Kim Jong-un's sister released a letter basically just blasting South Korea's presidential office as idiotic. Then on Thursday, Kim Jong-un sent a letter to South Korea talking about, you know, the wonderful friendship they have, and it was a very conciliatory letter. And now we have another missile launch. So there's a lot of mixed messages going on here. And this, of course, comes as people believe that North Korea is dealing with what is likely to be its own coronavirus outbreak.
So we just don't know about that part of it, do we, because of the secretive nature of that nation?
Yeah, we basically know nothing about what is going on in North Korea regarding the coronavirus. They have not reported any cases. However, that seems unlikely, given their proximity to China. North Korea did shut the border down, or attempt to shut the border down with China, basically sooner than anyone else did, as soon as this outbreak happened in January. But there's a lot of holes in that border. They rely on trade with China. It seems unlikely that they could have kept the virus out completely.
Well, regarding these projectiles, it sounds like these were personally overseen by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Are you hearing any analysts over there in South Korea with any sort of speculation as to why he's ramping this stuff up again now?
We don't know yet many details about the specifics of this launch, but it appears to be short range. And the reason I say that is because South Korea's military says that three projectiles were fired this morning. That is consistent with what they have done repeatedly over the past year with these short range multiple rocket launchers. They usually launch two. Sometimes they attempt three at the same time. So these are short range. They pose a big danger to South Korea and to U.S. troops, but they're not the kind of provocations that could totally upend diplomacy with the United States, which is sort of non-existent for now anyway. But the bottom line is Donald Trump has not reacted firmly to these types of launches in the past, and he is unlikely to do so this launch.
Well, it sounds like a number of EU nations, including Britain, Germany, France, Belgium, Estonia, are going to the UN Security Council over this, or they already did last week.
Yes, and this is pretty standard behavior because these launches by North Korea violate UN Security Council resolution. Even if the United States right now isn't too upset about these launches, Donald Trump consistently plays them down, many European nations are concerned because it violates international law. In North Korea, of course, every time this happens, they get very sensitive to those types of accusations, and they release angry statements. They did so in this case as well, but it's sort of a pattern that seems to just escalate and escalate and escalate. We don't know where it will end at this point.
All right, that's VOA Seoul correspondent Bill Gallo. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders each picked up significant endorsements for their presidential bids over the weekend. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
I have decided that I am, with great enthusiasm, going to endorse Joe Biden.
Senator Kamala Harris joins a cluster of one-time rivals for the nomination, posting a video statement Sunday.
We need a leader who really does care about the people, and who can therefore unify the people. And I believe Joe can do that.
I stand with Bernie Sanders today.
But at a rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Bernie Sanders picked up his own endorsement from the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
He's never lost his taste for justice for the people.
And Sanders tells ABC's This Week he's not surprised to see the Democratic establishment rallying around Biden.
But we are winning the support of grassroots America because we have an agenda that speaks to working people.
I'm Ben Thomas.
Well, Sunday was International Women's Day, and it has also been 100 years since the 19th Amendment was passed, giving women the right to vote in the United States. To commemorate the centennial, the New York Historical Society has launched a special exhibit called Women March. It explores women's collective action before and after the suffrage victory all the way into the 21st century. VOA's Penelope Pulu visited the exhibit and spoke with the curators.
The exhibit Women March at the New York Historical Society in New York City takes the visitor along 200 years of women's collective action in American history. Photographs, drawings, and archival video footage bring their activism to life. It started as early as the 1820s, says the society's Valerie Paley.
Women came together as these moral arbiters of a new nation. And we're speaking out against slavery and Indian removal and all sorts of issues by lending their names to petitions, in a way a proto-women's march, if you will.
100 years later, the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920 granted women the right to vote. A digital interactive map shows the 19th Amendment was not inclusive. It took decades before all American women could vote, with wealthy white women being the first and black women in the South enjoying the same right only after the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. And though white women and black women formed a coalition during that period, their perspectives were often divided along racial lines, says Pamela Walker, a team member of the exhibit.
One thing that was really significant and really important for this exhibition is to show that in any movement for women's rights and women's liberation, that there will always be tension, that women are coming from different perspectives, whether you're a white woman or a Latinx woman, or a black woman.
The latter part of the exhibit focuses on women's collective action from the 1970s through today. During this period, women marched to demand legal rights equal to men. They also marched on issue-driven topics such as gun control and reproductive rights, says Caitlin Wisner, another team member of the exhibit.
One thing that I think the Women's March of January 2017 and subsequent women's marches did was bring together an incredibly diverse group of women who share the identity of being women, but also have a multitude of other identities.
Women of color, women in the gay community, and feminists of all genders all marched together in cities all over the world one day after President Trump was inaugurated in 2017. To send a message that women's rights are human rights. Since then, women march on a broad swath of issues such as climate change, gun violence, sexual assault, and sexual discrimination. Women from all walks of life come together through digital technology and form global internet movements such as hashtag MeToo. Caitlin Wisner says the exhibit shows that securing the vote 100 years ago was just the beginning.
The idea that beyond the vote, beyond many legal hallmarks of equality, we always must keep safeguarding what we have fought so hard for.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, New York City.
Well, coming up, an eco-friendly alternative to the massive problem of plastic solution. Pollution.
Forest everywhere. It just really bothered me. And so I started doing the research into the material just to make sure that no matter if a material is left in nature again, at least it would work to help the environment rather than harm it.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Conservation International says an estimated 8 million metric tons of plastic go into the ocean every year. And that's not even counting the amount that ends up in landfills or by the side of the road. But slowly, environmentally conscious entrepreneurs are creating alternatives to plastic products. VOA's Eunshin Lee reports.
The difference between these two is if you crumble in, they don't like to come back by the plastic bottles.
Right.
Cameron Ross started the Salise Bioproducts Company to produce single-use plastic alternatives from plant materials. They are made of polylactic acid, known as PLA, from cornstarches.
We work with food service providers, predominantly larger brands, to help them get quality, sustainable, and cost-effective solutions made from plants to start getting rid of single-use plastics.
Single-use plastics such as bottles or straws are a major cause of pollution. When we throw these away, they end up in a landfill or in the water like rivers. According to researchers, it could take up to more than 500 years for them to properly decompose. Ross says he wasn't always so environmentally conscious himself, but ever since a hiking trip in West Virginia, when he spent more time picking up trash than enjoying nature, his priorities changed.
There's just a ton of plastic just all over the, all in the forest, everywhere. It just really bothered me, and so I started doing the research into the material just to make sure that no matter if a material is left in nature again, at least it would work to help the environment rather than harm it.
That meant making biodegradable products that can break down in only a few years. While many cafes and restaurants are choosing paper products to be more eco-conscious, it isn't cheap. Paper straws can cost about 8 times more than plastic straws. But bioplastic straws cost less than a penny a straw, not even double the price of plastic ones. Another problem with paper straws is that they get soggy.
You don't want to be sipping something that alters your drink or starts to melt while you're drinking it, and then you have to get another paper straw, which then creates more waste than needed.
Ross hopes his Washington, D.C.-based company will provide an eco-friendly solution for food service providers. Eunchin Lee, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
Disturbances on the sun have the potential to wreak havoc with Earth's power grids and communication equipment. A new study by biologists at Duke University in North Carolina and an astronomer from the Adler Planetarium in Chicago suggests that solar storms could also mix up the navigational abilities of whales, causing them to be stranded or beached on land. Scientists have found that some animal species can detect Earth's magnetic field and use it as a kind of GPS to navigate their migrations. The study's authors say that solar storms could be disrupting signals from that magnetic field. They suspect radio frequency noise created when high-energy solar particles smack into the magnetic field could be overpowering the whale's senses. It would be like turning off their GPS during the middle of their journey. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, with an obvious baby bump, Katy Perry paid tribute to International Women's Day with a performance of some of her biggest hits at the Women's T20 World Cup in Melbourne, Australia. The singer recently announced she's expecting her first child with fiancé Orlando Bloom. Listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. From zero to my own heat.
This is VOA.